headlines. Iran seizes two Greek oil tankers in the Persian Gulf 2 days after the seizure of an Iranian oil cargo by Greece. People protest outside the National Rifle Association's annual convention in Houston, Texas, days after 19 students and two teachers were shot dead in a school. Also ahead, Cuba, Venezuela and Nicaragua condemn Washington's decision to exclude some Latin American countries from the upcoming Summit of the Americas. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has seized the two Greek oil tankers in the Persian Gulf waters south of the country. In a statement, the IRGC said the vessels were seized for, quote, violations committed. According to shipping sources, Swiss Max's Delta Poseidon and Prudent Warrior had both loaded at Basra port in Iraq. The latter was carrying an oil cargo for the United States. The incident comes just days after Greece seized the oil cargo of an Iranian-flagged tanker and moved to deliver the crude to the United States. The Iranian Foreign Ministry has already summoned the Swiss and the Greek chargé d'affaires over the issue. Switzerland represents U.S. interests in Iran. The ministry slammed the U.S. violation of international law and maritime conventions governing free navigation and trade. It also demanded the immediate release of the seized ship and its cargo. Political commentator Said Mohammed Mirandi believes by seizing the Greek-flagged tankers, Tehran is sending a message to Washington and its allies warning them against harming Iran's oil trade.
Well, I think it's quite obvious. The Iranians are sending a message to NATO that if you touch our oil, you will pay the price. And the price of oil will go through the roof. The market is very tight. There is a shortage of oil. And the world economy is heading towards a major recession. So if the Americans and the Europeans want to make the situation much worse, then they could continue pushing the globe towards further tension. If they want to ease the oil market, then the only way forward is to respect international law, end their piracy, and to refrain from touching Iranian oil, Iranian assets, and which include Iranian tankers and super tankers.
Elsewhere, Israeli regime forces have killed a Palestinian teenager in an attack on Palestinian protesters in the south of the occupied West Bank. Medical sources said the regime troops shot dead the young Palestinian in the village of El-Khadir. Meanwhile, regime troops also attacked protesters in several locations in Nablus province in northern West Bank, leaving at least 90 injured. They used rubber-coated bullets, tear gas, and stun grenades. Palestinians regularly hold anti-Israel protests after Friday prayers across the occupied West Bank. The demonstrators are angry at the continued Israeli aggression against the Palestinians and the regime's occupation of their land. Israeli forces have carried out several deadly raids in the territory in recent weeks, most notably killing Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Aqla in Jenin. A pro-Palestinian Church of England priest has faced a disciplinary tribunal in London over the past week for criticizing Israel and for what he calls Christian Zionist support for it. It comes after renewed complaints of anti-Semitism against Reverend Stephen Sizer by a Jewish group in Britain. Saeed Poreza reports on the final day of the proceedings.
What they lack in number, they make up for in solidarity. Supporters of a British pro-Palestine priest facing a week-long Church of England tribunal here for his views on Israel. 68-year-old Reverend Stephen Sizer, a retired Anglican vicar known for his opposition to Christian Zionism, A belief among some Christians that the establishment of Israel in 1948 was in accordance with biblical prophecy accused of anti-Semitism.
We're concerned about how people who are speaking up against the crimes against humanity that are being committed by apartheid Israel are being targeted. And people and organizations in this country that are apologists for apartheid, that are actually supportive of the apartheid state of Israel, are actually using regulatory processes to actually target individuals and stop any kind of dissent from being said.
One such group, the Pro-Israel Board of Deputies of British Jews, that's accused Dr. Sizer of making public statements that conflicts with the so-called International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition of anti-Semitism adopted by the Church of England. The definition conflates harsh criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism.
There's no exemption from their attempt to shut down pro-Palestinian discourse. And the reason is very simple. They've lost the debate. If they were winning the debate, they wouldn't be trying to shut down Stephen Sizer, but they know that public opinion, because of what Israel does and because of the Palestinian resistance, they know that they're very, very unpopular in public opinion.
And it's not the first time this is happening. Dr. Sizer faced similar accusations in 2013, but was exonerated in return for not posting about Palestine on social media. Nearly 10 years later, he's once again the subject of a pro-Israel witch hunt.
I think it's because Reverend Dr. Stephen Sizer was not obedient, and he continued to advocate for Palestine and against the crimes of the State of Israel, and they decided to bring him to heel in an exemplary way. You know, they've pretty much cleaned out the Labour Party. They've got scalps there. They've attacked people in academia. They got people fired in Bristol. They've even tried to take on musicians like Lowkey.
A final verdict is expected in the coming weeks, but what this case and similar ones show, these activists say, is the length to which the British state will go in silencing all criticism of Israel and its apartheid against Palestinians. Saeed Bouriza, London.
Now, anger is boiling in the United States over the recent fatal shooting at a Texas elementary school. Hundreds of protesters converge on the annual convention of the powerful gun lobbying group, the National Rifle Association, in Houston.
Not time to fix this problem, and they've only made it worse. What are we going to do?
The demonstrators held signs and chanted slogans demanding stricter gun control laws as the association's members gathered for the convention. The NRA has faced criticism for deciding to hold the gathering. Activists say it should have rather held a memorial ceremony for the victims of the school shooting. On Tuesday, an 18-year-old shooter massacred 19 children and two teachers at an elementary school in Uvalde, Texas. The incident has also raised criticism of the police, with officials acknowledging that officers were slow to take action.
Hey, from the benefit of hindsight, where I'm sitting now, of course it was not the right decision. It was the wrong decision, period. There's no excuse for that. But again, I wasn't there, but I'm just telling you, from what we know, we believe there should have been an entry at that as soon as you can.
The official added that the police received several emergency calls reporting that 8 or 9 children were still alive while the shooting was underway. Despite that, officers held back from making an entry for over half an hour. This has sparked fears that such instances of police inaction could cost lives during active shootings. The Cuban president has accused the U.S. of hegemonic practices after Washington handpicked Latin American states for the summit of the Americas.
The practice of exclusion is not new and confirms the United States' interest in controlling the inter-American system for hegemonic purposes and imposing its power to oversee democracy. This right does not correspond to them politically or morally. They claim to be promoters of democracy, which they deliberately confuse with their own system, but are unable to guarantee a plural space.
Miguel Diaz-Canel made the comments during a meeting of the 11-country ALBA bloc in Cuba. He had earlier announced that he would not attend the Summit of the Americas, which is scheduled for June. The U.S. has officially said it will not invite Venezuela and Nicaragua. Washington claims that the Venezuelan government is illegitimate and accuses the Nicaraguan president of authoritarianism. The U.S. has faced criticism for its decision, with several Latin American leaders threatening to boycott the events. Russia takes control of the railroad hub of Lyman as part of an assault aimed at capturing the last Ukrainian-held area in the eastern Donbass region. Pro-Russians say they have been in full control of Lyman. Ukrainian officials acknowledge that Russia captured most of the town. Ukraine's defense ministry says its forces are still blocking the Russians from launching an advance towards the nearby city of Sloviansk. Ukrainian officials say Russian forces have encircled two-thirds of Severodonetsk, the biggest city held by Ukraine in the Donbass. Despite the Russian advances on the two major fronts in the Donbass, Ukraine says its forces still hold new defensive lines there. Russia's operation in Ukraine was launched in late February. While the Russian army continues its advances in the Donbass region of Ukraine, our correspondent Johnny Miller reports from a town near the front line recently taken by Russia.
This is the road to Svetlodarsk, a town in Donbass recently taken by the Russian army and separatist militias.
We've stopped just outside the town in Ukrainian positions. There used to be Ukrainian positions, but they've now left. I've been told to take off my press identification on my vest here because if there are snipers, they may well target journalists.
The town is home to around 10,000 people, most of whom stayed during the fighting. I'm surprised to see little damage here.
Nothing happened, fortunately, in the town itself. But the joint forces of the DPR, LPR, and Russia broke the so-called Svetlodarsk Arc, and the enemy lost all interest in fighting and left, so the battle is now behind the town. Kiev do not give their army enough motivation. We're on our land, and we're defending it. And at the moment, we're going forward. They are on foreign land.
Up on this plinth, in this square here, there would have been a Russian statue. My translator think it may have been a statue of Lenin, but the Ukrainians have been pulling down these statues, trying to erase any Russian culture or signs of Russian culture in areas they take. But now this is back under Russian control, this town.
These last 8 years, we've been living under humiliation. And when the Russian soldiers came, we've been waiting for them. But we are also Russians. We understand Russians. We think and live like Russians do. That's why we were waiting for them.
First of all, I think it will be easier to breathe. We do not understand yet. Our fear is that the Russian military will move on and leave the town without defense, and that we will be under shelling again.
There will be people in this town who do not welcome the Russian soldiers here, who are more pro-Ukrainian, but either they have fled or they might be worried about saying that out loud. It's clear that the majority of people here anyway welcome the Russian soldiers.
I am taken to a townhouse which served as a Ukrainian military base, the remnants of what the soldiers left as they fled. They tried to hide tanks here, but the building was still struck by a Russian airstrike.
Now, these are pictures drawn by children, quite possibly sent to the Ukrainian soldiers. These ones here say, "We want peace." This one here says, "Please return alive."
As the Russian army continues their advance in Donbass, more towns like this, in the coming days and weeks, will raise the Russian flag. Meanwhile, civilians throughout the Donbass, whether pro-Russian or pro-Ukrainian, will be hoping that this war will soon come to an end. Svetlodarsk.
Two-time Prime Minister Romano Prodi has expressed serious concerns over the consequences associated with the Ukraine-Russia conflict. Prodi has warned the sanctions against Moscow would cost a lot mainly to Italy, Germany and the European Union.
On Friday, two-time Prime Minister of Italy and former President of the European Union, Romano Prodi, had his say on the Ukraine crisis and subsequent geopolitical developments during a meeting with journalists held at the International Press Association headquarters in Rome, known for having oversaw an extensive privatization of Italy's public assets and for his lack of ostentation. Prodi is today a retired politician. He expressed serious concerns at how the sanctions imposed against Russia over the conflict in Ukraine will reverberate through the European Union, with the risk of creating divisions among the members of the bloc.
The Ukraine crisis fallout will hit the EU badly. Sanctions would cost a lot to Italy and Germany, less to other EU countries. Brussels has reacted unitedly to Russia, but peace must remain paramount.
Italy and Germany are the countries which have relied on Russian energy the most over the past 20 years. Rome has been trying to diversify its energy sources, but it will take at least 2-3 years before it achieves a total replacement of Russian gas. Since the start of the war in Ukraine, Rome has been trying to wean itself off Russian gas, which currently accounts for over 40% of total gas imports. However, according to the National Bureau of Statistics, is that Italy's imports from Russia rose around 120% in value in April, while Italian exports to Russia showed an annual fall of almost 50% in the same period.
I have said many times that the impact of the sanctions against Russia will be completely asymmetrical. It goes without saying that the consequences on some countries like France or Spain will be milder.
Earlier this week, Moscow dismissed the plan for peace in Ukraine proposed by Italy. Also, Hungary has urged Brussels to call explicitly for a ceasefire in Ukraine. However, so far, some members of the bloc and the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen have adopted a hawkish posture on Russia, never making any mention of peace talks. Max Civili, Rome.
France's new prime minister has become just the second woman to hold the nation's number two post, but new polls reveal major pessimism. The country will vote in legislative elections next month, which will determine how much power the new government truly wields. That brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Researchers have found 1 in 8 COVID hospital patients have heart inflammation up to 2 months later. We now present you an article written by Nicola Davis. The piece is titled Study Finds COVID Can Cause Ongoing Damage to Heart, Lungs and Kidneys. Researchers have revealed damage to the body's organs, including the lungs and kidneys, in common in people who were admitted to hospital with COVID, with 1 in 8 found to have heart inflammation. As the pandemic evolved, it became clear that some people who had COVID were being left with ongoing symptoms, a condition that has been called long COVID. Previous studies have revealed that fewer than a third of patients who have ongoing COVID symptoms after being hospitalized with the disease feel fully recovered a year later, while some experts have warned long COVID could result in a generation affected by disability. Now, researchers tracking the progress of patients who were treated in hospital for COVID say they have found evidence the disease can take a toll on a range of body's organs. What's more, they say the severity of ongoing symptoms appears to be linked to the severity of the COVID infection itself. Professor Colin Berry from the University of Glasgow, which led the CISCO19 or cardiac imaging in SARS coronavirus disease 19 study, said even fit, healthy individuals can suffer severe COVID-19 illness, and to avoid this, members of the public should take up the offer of vaccination. Professor Colin Berry added, our study provides objective evidence of abnormalities at 1 to 2 months post-COVID, and these findings tie in with persisting symptoms at that time and the likelihood of ongoing health needs 1 year later. Writing in the journal Nature Medicine, the researchers describe how they tracked the outcomes of 159 people hospitalized with COVID between May of 2020 and March of 2021. The research team carried out a range of scans and blood tests at 28 to 60 days after the COVID patients were discharged from hospital, with patients also given questionnaires to complete. The results were compared with those from a control group of 29 people with a similar age, sex, ethnicity, and cardiovascular risk factors who had not had COVID. The authors of the report write that, compared with controls, those who had been hospitalized with COVID showed several abnormalities, including in results from imaging of the heart, lungs, and kidneys. The team found about 13% or 1 in 8 of those hospitalized for COVID were deemed by experts to be very likely to have myocarditis or heart inflammation, compared with just one control participant. Dr. Andrew Morrow, also from the University of Glasgow, said this led to a lower heart-related quality of life, greater illness perception, higher levels of anxiety and depression, and lower levels of physical activity. The likelihood of myocarditis was higher among healthcare workers and those with acute kidney injury, as well as those with more severe disease requiring invasive ventilation. Dr. Andrew Morrow said these findings reinforce the importance of both the vaccine program and novel treatments that have greatly reduced the number of severe cases of COVID-19. The results also revealed those who had been hospitalized with COVID were more likely to need outpatient secondary care or be referred for symptoms consistent with long COVID, with death and rehospitalizations also much higher in this group. Dr. Betty Raman, a cardiologist and long COVID expert at the University of Oxford, who was not involved in the study, said the study provided important insights into the prevalence of clinically adjudicated myocarditis and its association with prolonged symptoms in those hospitalized with COVID early in the pandemic. However, Dr. Betty Raman noted that presence of persistent heart inflammation was not assessed during later follow-up. Few participants had received a COVID jab, and the COVID variants involved were unlikely to be the Omicron lineages that are prevalent today. She said, current day estimates of myocarditis following more novel SARS-CoV-2 variants in the post-vaccine era may differ from this study, given the lower risk of hospitalization and severe disease attributable to differences in variants and vaccine effects. Meanwhile, a leading expert has warned long COVID could create a generation affected by disability, with people forced out of their homes and work, and some even driven to suicide. In an exclusive interview with The Guardian, Professor Danny Altman, an immunologist at Imperial College University of London, said that the UK's current approach to COVID fails to take the impact of infection sufficiently seriously, adding that more needs to be done to aid diagnosis and treatment of long COVID. Professor Danny Altman said, "It's kind of an anathema to me that we've kind of thrown in the towel on control of Omicron wave infections and have said it's endemic and we don't care anymore because it's very benign." Professor Altman added, "It just isn't, and there are new people joining the long COVID support groups all the time with their disabilities. It's really not okay, and it's heartbreaking." According to data from the Office for National Statistics, by the end of January this year, about 1.5 million people, or 2.4% of the population in the United Kingdom, said they were experiencing ongoing symptoms more than 4 weeks after their first suspected COVID infection, with 45% reporting that infection was a year or more ago. The findings chime with a recent UK study that found only around 1 in 3 patients who had ongoing COVID symptoms after being hospitalised with the disease reported feeling fully recovered a year later. Asked whether long COVID could lead to a generation affected by disability, Professor Danny Altman agreed. He said, "Yes, totally." But he emphasised that long COVID is not limited to the United Kingdom. Professor Altman said, "This is a global problem. We've got at least 5 million people on the planet with long COVID. That is very much a lower limit estimate. And they've all got a wide array of problems and they are big problems. It's going to drive people out of housing, out of work, and in some cases it's going to drive them to suicide." An expert on T cells and autoimmunity, Professor Danny Altman has recently teamed up with journalist Jez Menninger, who himself has long COVID, to write the Long COVID Handbook, set to be published later this year. For Professor Altman, the decision to become involved in research into COVID and its ongoing impact was a no-brainer. He said, "We were people who had decades worth of viral immunology and autoimmunity. So, you know, what else have we been training for?" But long COVID is far from simple. One study has suggested the condition is associated with more than 200 symptoms, from brain fog to heart palpitations, while microscopic damage to the lungs, microclots, and low level of certain antibodies are among the mechanisms that experts have suggested could be linked to long COVID.
Oh, This is Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to the IRIB English Radio. This is Back to Reality, and I am your host, Zainab Askari. In this program, we do a roundtable discussion on the very interesting topics. And today also, we're going to discuss one of the very interesting topics with two of the very special guests. I have with me Siddique on my left side and Fatima on my right side. I would want you guys to introduce yourself. Let's start from Fatima.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. My name is Fatima Peabody. I'm from Southern California, U.S. I've been here in Qom this time a little over 5 years. I studied a little bit at Jamatul Zahra Hawza. Since then, I'm just teaching a little bit of English conversation classes here and there and just attending lectures and my own kind of self-study, enjoying the Qom life.
Well, thank you, Fatima. Nice to meet you. How are you, Siddique? Let's know something about you, too.
Thank you. Yes, my name is Siddique. I am from the UK, specifically London. And I've been in Qom as well for around 5 to 6 years now. And I study in Bint al-Huda. My field of specialization is fiqh and usul, which basically deals with jurisprudence, the nitty-gritty of how the rules are derived.
True. So nice to meet both of you.
Thank you.
All right. So today we'll discuss about a very interesting topic that everyone is talking about, that's trending all the time. That's love. Siddique, I'll start from you. What's love?
Okay. First, we need to know the difference between love and lust.
And infatuation.
And infatuation. Exactly.
Yes. Wow.
What attraction. We usually, so many things. Yeah. So what? Love is sacred. You know, Allah talks about love in the Quran. He talks about loving the Prophet, and Allah will love you. You know, he talks about mawadda. He talks about the verse where the Prophet says, I do not ask of any reward from you apart from love for my family. Mm. Love is sacred. Love is what is between you and Allah. Even that love can be projected in your family. Like Allah says, when you marry, I will come and put love and rahmah within you.
Wow.
So love is sacred. Lust is not. Lust is required in a relationship, in a valid marriage relationship. That is absolutely important. But apart from that, when we start crossing the barriers, then it's no longer sacred. But then today, with the word love is used so loosely, the people have lost the real meaning of it.
Mm-hmm.
And if we see, again, Sahifa Sajjadiyah, the whispered prayers of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, one of them is the whispered prayers of the lovers. And he goes into this whole conversation with Allah, explain to him how much I love you.
That's
true
love.
If I find you, why would I want to go to anyone else?
Mm-hmm.
Imam Hussein as well, right? And Karbala, one who has found you, what has he lost? And one who has lost you, what has he found? Those are absolute descriptions of true, pure love.
Yes,
I'm not saying love is restricted to between you and Allah. It's there with it, but Allah instills that love within your family as well.
Yes, yes.
That's why it says, if you marry, I will give you that love.
True.
And that's why marriage, which is based on the pure foundations that Allah has spoken about, alhamdulillah, many marriages go on to have very successful futures. Yes, some marriages are not successful, but there are reasons, and inshallah, those can be worked upon.
Yeah, and we have also in Surah Maidah that if they love him, he loves them too. And yes, we have that. You said love is sacred. I really agree with that. And in India, again, mm-hmm. I'll go back to India. In India also, they say, yes, love can be sacred, but the love that is being, advertised so much, that is being shown, is not the true love. And the sacred one, love, is given a different term that's called as ishq. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
I would want to ask you, Fatima, since you're from California, what is love?
First, between the servant and Allah, and our love for Ahl Bayt al-Islam, all of those really the spiritual things, number one. The first true love is between us and Allah, and if we can, to the Prophet and Ahl Bayt. But I think a lot of people, especially in the West, they're so confused because there's just so much emphasis on attraction, infatuation, lust, just getting what you want right away. I think with true love, it takes time. You're not going to get a true love, you know, you just talk to the person for a few days and then boom, let's get married. That's attraction and lust and infatuation and admiration too. I think All right. There's a lot of sisters, as myself, Mix that was pain. My problem in the previous marriage. Admiration, like intellectual admiration, like you're so amazed by their intellect and
you're obsessed with someone.
Yeah, and he's studying perfect, even though he's not a native speaker. These are intellectual admirations and infatuations. This is not a true love.
All right.
So I think it's very, very rare. It's very, very rare. That's why divorce is on the rise. The U.S., it's like more than 50% of marriages end in divorce, even among Muslim, non-Muslim,
and
because they don't understand. No, they don't really understand what is the true love. You know.
And talking about U.S., we have so many single parents.
Yeah.
We have so many single parents or they're like, maybe after having a kid, they realize that they never loved that person.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is happening so
and
much.
And having a child with somebody, it's kind of like you have a, unless you're going to, God forbid, abandon your child.
Yeah.
You're going, even if you're living separately from the child, you're always going to have a certain connection. If the person is suffering from all kind of, you know, mental illnesses or other thing, and you cut off, still, you know, whenever you see the child, obviously going to remind you. So having a child with somebody, it never finishes that connection until the child grow up and whatever. But it still doesn't create how you can have 10 kids and live with somebody 50 years and still not have a true love. It's not going to. The true love comes from Allah. And I think only Allah, it's a kind of a blessing from Allah. He only instills it in you. And then I think also it's happened to a lot of people that I know, and I just know about it, that it starts off after our connection to Allah and that true love. If we had, I know this from psychology and reading and experiencing, if we had healthy caregivers in the early childhood, because the girls develop faster than the boys, if as women we had in the early childhood from, they say around the time of 3 to 4 years old to 5 years old, your personality starts forming until you reach the balagha age. If you had a caregivers who were loving to you, expressing love to you and parenting you correctly, especially the mother and the father both, especially girls need from the father, then you develop that self-esteem and love for yourself, then you're going to be more able to recognize. It's easier, I think, to see, even though some people that had that still have hardship, but I think it's a little bit easier than those who didn't have it. You don't have a love for yourself, then you're going to have more danger later on. You got to be careful for that and choosing the correct partner, spouse.
Choosing the correct. Yeah.
There's a very interesting point that you mentioned about love and relationships. Children and everything. What I do want to sort of point to is that some people, and this is unfortunate, but it does happen, especially in some marriages, some relationships, abusive relationships especially, the husband might say, I'm hitting you because I love you. Please don't be fooled. That's not love.
Wow.
Right? If anyone is in an abusive relationship, you need to take help, right? And often love is misused in different dimensions, right? Someone might mistake lust to be love, and someone might stay in an abusive relationship under the pretext that they're yeah. love.
You manipulation. Said someone, it's a manipulation.
You said someone might mistake lust as love. We have girls growing up who, unfortunately, I know most of them, get least care from home because of like, I don't know, anything can be the reason. Like maybe the parents are not expressive all the time, but parents always love.
A mother always loves. The father has to love the daughter correctly
everyone,
or she's going to have issue.
I don't say that.
Yeah.
Parents don't love their kids, but it might be the problem of expression. Sometimes
expressing
parents
their love,
not
yeah.
are not able to express their love to their kids. And when these kids grow up, and someone
outside issue.
Comes in, tells in their teens them, I love you. And they straight away get slipped. And as you correctly mentioned, that they take lust as love. How can they be protected? I ask you, Siddiqa.
Parents need to express love to the children. You know,
I know I can understand how it can be a bit difficult for men, especially men who are not very expressive. Mm-hmm. But there's some very good techniques, like when you're talking to a child, mm-hmm. especially those in the toddler years, lower yourself to the eye level.
Yeah.
When you're talking to them, lower yourself so they feel they're on the same page as you.
Yeah.
Then you start to build a connection with them.
Mm-hmm.
A child will always come and tell you, and you know, even if they're joking, they might come and tell you, "I love you."
Yeah.
Respond. Even if you're feeling a bit shy, it's okay. Respond. Respond. Let the child know you are there for them.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the times as well, you know, children, they might act out at home.
Yeah.
And some people suggest, now I'm not giving a general blanket sort of statement, but mm-hmm. in some cases it does come up because they want attention.
Yeah.
Attention in the form of love, you know, just a hug. You can't say, "I love you," hug the child.
Yeah.
Touch the child. You know, let them feel that you're there for them.
Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Back to Reality, where we are having a roundtable discussion on love. Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him and his family, said, "Tell your wives in the Uhud book, I love you." And most of the men, especially men, are so much least expressive. Got,
yeah.
I'm done with these men. I mean, my brothers,
all the men parents, I know. It depends on their parents too, how they raise them.
Yeah. And I think there's one more thing, you know, women sometimes, women are most expressive. They sometimes get gifts and they get, I don't know, flowers for the husband. They get so many things for the husbands. But then, does this husband really need the gifts?
No.
Or does he need power? What do you think?
I think he needs the respect and to feel that he's needed. Because the biggest problem, I think, in the Western culture and then all these countries over here, especially the youth here, they're trying to copy the West. Everybody's so excited about the West and I want to go study abroad and they want to copy the Western culture,
mm-hmm.
is that the woman is like this so independent and she can get a job, she can earn the money, she can earn even more than him and do everything, take care of the kids, take care of the house, take care of the bills. So then what's left? Like if she's doing everything, you know, and then cook and clean and like everything she's doing, then what is he going to be there? Just to come and like pay for like a couple of little bills and then like, okay, you know, he has to feel like he's needed and he has to feel like he's respected in the house. And I think that's one of the biggest problem in the West. They're not respected. They just feel like, okay, what's the point of me being here? You know, just to have some babies and bring a little bit of, pay a couple of bills. What else am I here for? You know,
yeah, well, I think that respect is a problem both in the West and in Asia as well.
Yeah.
I come from India and I know that people are so much hungry for this respect that they sometimes even misuse that respect. They so much downgrade women. They think that she's just like they consider her as a slave, while as Islam has given her very, very highest positions, like I must say sometimes somewhere more than men. Well, thank you so much, guys, for coming on the show. We came to the conclusion that love is sacred and lust is something that is sometimes misunderstood as love. There is infatuation, there is admiration, there is lust.
Emotional manipulation, love. Using people for money and other things. These are all different. Yeah.
These are all different things and we need to understand what is real love. And we have a request to the parents that you love your children, we know that, but express that love, because if you're not going to express that love, maybe someone telling them outside, "I love you," will get them dragged to some other track. So be expressive. Everyone who loves their loved ones, their partners, their children need to express this. Expressing love is really
important.
And
I think people should get a little bit of counseling too before getting married, not just getting married so quick, you know?
Yeah. So counseling is important. Knowing people is important. Knowing each other is important. Thank you so much, Siddiqa. Thank you so much, Fatima. Thank you so much for being with us. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. This was Back to Reality. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Ya Allah,
يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي التي ما rise again let us see daylight again once again
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Documents show that in 2021, arms made and funded by the United States of America destroyed UNRWA schools and USAID projects in Gaza. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Daniel Baxla, journalist. This article is titled, Zionist regime used U.S. weapons to destroy assets and projects in Gaza. Here's the story. Last May, in an assault on the occupied Gaza Strip, the Zionist regime deployed hundreds of bombs, missiles, and shells, killing over 240 Palestinians and wounding more than 1,900 others. More than half of the dead were civilians. According to the Israeli think tank Meir Amit Intelligence and Terrorism Information Center, despite the Zionist regime's claims that it only targets combatants, at the end of the 11-day assault, tens of thousands of Gazans were displaced from damaged homes, already struggling in a region with a 50% unemployment rate, toxic water, and crumbling infrastructure. Thousands of housing units, hundreds of schools, and 19 healthcare facilities were also damaged. Compounding the devastating toll on Palestinian civilians, weapons made and funded by the United States were used to destroy American humanitarian projects and businesses, documents and reporting reviewed by The Intercept show. The destruction reached multiple hospitals and water treatment facilities supported by the U.S. Agency for International Development. Dozens of schools operated by the State Department-funded United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees in the Near East, or UNRWA, and a Coca-Cola plant built by a U.S. citizen. Raed Jarar, Advocacy Director at Democracy for the Arab World Now, or DAWN, told Intercept, "The vast majority of ammunition used by Israel is manufactured or subsidized by the United States of America." It's fair to say that every Israeli munition is subsidized by the U.S. one way or another by U.S. tax dollars. Impoverished in no small part thanks to a decade-and-a-half-long Israeli regime blockade, Gaza relies heavily on foreign aid to avert the worst humanitarian outcomes. The U.S. State Department had just renewed a lapsed funding commitment to the UNRWA, contributing $150 million to support more than 500,000 Palestinians visit schools and health care facilities. According to documents compiled from the United Nations, the Palestinian Authority, the human rights groups, more than 100 UNRWA facilities in Gaza were damaged in the 11-day bombing campaign in May 2021, requiring over $1 million in repairs. Dozens more schools administered by the Palestinian Authority suffered similar damage. It was hardly the first time that the U.S.-funded weapons had been used to destroy aid projects the different countries support. In 2014, during an earlier Israeli regime attack on Gaza, a Hellfire missile manufactured and paid for by the United States of America targeted an UNRWA school, killing 10 Palestinians. The massacre drew widespread condemnation, even eliciting a rare rebuke from different administrations who decried it as totally indefensible. What remained unspoken then was the fact that both the missile and the school was funded by the United States regime. The U.S. State Department was not the only federal agency whose funds supported aid projects that U.S. weaponry destroyed. Documents and news reviewed by Intercept show that more than a dozen factories in East Gaza's industrial zone built with funding from USAID, along with several USAID-funded projects for providing water, hygiene, and sanitation, were struck by U.S. weapons. In Khan Yunis, Rafah, and Beit Lahia, wastewater treatment infrastructure and water reservoir funded by aid, which the U.S. regime spent millions to construct, were destroyed by aerial attacks that affected more than 300,000 civilians, again by U.S. weapons. 97% of the water in Gaza is contaminated, resulting in a widespread public health crisis, rendered even worse by the destruction of U.S.-funded water infrastructure. A major reason for the perpetuation of the Israeli occupation and the deaths and suffering which accompany it is the extraordinary military, diplomatic, and political support given to it largely without conditions by the United States of America, said Michael Link, the recently departed UN Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territories, adding, "This American military assistance is provided notwithstanding the fact that congressional laws governing U.S. weapons exports state that recipient countries cannot be engaged in consistent patterns of gross human rights violations." While the fabricated regime of Israel is the largest recipient of U.S. military aid, it is subject to virtually no checks in operation, ensuring that U.S. weapons are not used to commit war crimes, destroy U.S.-funded projects, or damage the property of U.S. citizens in Gaza. Statutes that govern how aid to the Palestinian territories can be dispersed, however, are stringent. The audits ensuring that there are no ties between U.S. funding and different groups cost millions of dollars, sometimes exceeding the cost of the very aid projects being audited.
C
Since 1948, the United States has provided the fake regime of Israel with over $150 billion in assistance, receiving in exchange a foothold in a region of massive strategic importance. The current model exists under a memorandum of understanding that Barack Obama signed in 2016, committing to $38 billion in aid between 2019 and 2028, with an open-door policy for additional aid, like the $1 billion Congress gave the Zionist regime in March for its Iron Dome missile system. The aid system also provides cash flow financing, a system resembling layaway that allows the Israeli regime to purchase weapons in the present using money from the future. And it contains an offshore procurement exemption offered to no other regime that allows the Zionist regime to spend U.S. tax dollars on its own weapons industry without disclosing how it spent the money to Congress or the American public. And of course, the United States maintains its own stockpiled weapons in the occupied territories available for use by Israeli forces, despite the Zionist regime's status as one of the largest arms exporters in the world. In two instances, the Zionist regime tapped into the U.S. stockpile to wage campaigns against the Palestinian groups. The end result is an Israeli arsenal almost entirely composed of weapons made or subsidized by the U.S. regime. While mechanisms for punishing war crimes perpetrated by the Zionist regime with the U.S. support are selectively enforced against many other countries, the lack of scrutiny over the Israeli forces' use of American weapons is glaring. Amid last May's onslaught, the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace detailed the number of U.S. laws violated by the Zionist regime's attacks. These included the Foreign Assistance Act, which stipulates that aid cannot be provided to a country which engages in a consistent pattern of gross violations of internationally recognized human rights. The Arms Export Control Act, which bans U.S. military assistance to countries using weapons for reasons other than legitimate self-defense, and the Lee Laws, named for outgoing U.S. Senator Patrick Lee, which ban weapon sales to military units that have committed a gross violation of human rights.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio.
Coming up is the news.